Hello, and welcome to Endeavors. Indecision keeps me on the line. Need another place to mind my mind. Give a little bit of God to sin. Keeping safe is keeping you away. My first guest could be described as a where-do-I-know-him-from type of actor. He has had bit parts in both X-Men First Class and Guardians of the Galaxy, and has also appeared in such films as Biker Boys, the Canadian indie darlings Child Star and Sugar, for which he received a Genie nomination for Best Actor in a Supporting Role, remake Silent Night, and the cult classic Final Destination. On television, he starred as a series regular in Roswell, which garnered him back-to-back Gemini nominations, as well as a Saturn Award nomination, and The Night Shift. He's had recurring parts in CSI Miami and Bones, and has guested on numerous other shows, including Breaker High, The New Addams Family, Nikita, Longmire, Better Call Saul, and Canadian favorite, Wynonna Earp. His latest film is Daughter of the Wolf, in which he stars opposite Gina Carano and Richard Dreyfuss. He is Brendan Fair, and I spoke with him last week. Brendan Fair, hello, good morning. Thanks for being here today, man.
Thank you for having me. Good morning to yourself.
So, you're in this intriguing new film, Daughter of the Wolf. There are a lot of, you know, lost in the wilderness survival films. What attracted you particularly to this story?
A couple things. One of the initial things that was intriguing was even before I had read the script, I was told that Rich Dreyfuss and Gina Carano were a part of it. So that was one thing kind of right off the bat that I thought was something that it was a real positive for me. Obviously, Dreyfuss, you know, Richard is a legend, and Gina, you know, is a bit in her own right, especially in the fighting world, where I first learned of her. And so it was those two were a big part of it early on. And then when I had read the script, you know, it was a character that I had an instinct about, that I had an idea of how to play him, and I hadn't been given the opportunity to play a character like that before. It was more of a follower, and most of the characters I play, if they're not outright leaders, they at least have some sort of leadership qualities to them, and this was a character that really didn't have any of those, given the way he had grown up and what had happened to him. He was devoid of kind of any sort of assertiveness or you know, kind of these action, you know, being proactive about anything. He was always very reactive. And so that was an interesting dynamic that I wanted to be able to play around with.
Larson finds himself part of a kidnapping team. How do you prepare for a role for a character that's in that mindset? Or are you somebody that likes to research a lot, or do you just sort of let the director take the lead on that?
I mean, you do as much research as you can, but to get into the mind of a kidnapper is, you know, I mean, what you're always asking yourself as an actor is, like, what is my intent? What is my objective? What am I trying to achieve? And then you know, once you keep asking that question, you're trying to achieve this. Okay, well, why am I trying to achieve that? And you just kind of keep breaking it down into these things. There comes a specificity with it, but you have to create this world or this kind of story where you can't really try to feel something. You either do or you don't. And so you have to create a world where you would be compelled to do something like this. Mine was an interesting one for this particular character, is because he had been kidnapped as well. And so it was an interesting one of those things I tried to do from the psychology of it, but it was similar to abused kids growing up to be abusers themselves, which is an interesting thing, because you would feel that would be the last thing that they would want to be, given the traumatic experience the kind of toll it took on them, which they're clearly very aware of. But things are taught and learned, and kids are influential, and they start to, once they start to grow up, and when you're put in a certain situation where, if you grow up with a lot of love, a lot of times you give a lot of love. If you grow up being, I in this particular character, he had grown up having been kidnapped and having had somewhat of a hard life, and so you become, that becomes normal to you. In some ways, that becomes the way life is led, because you don't know anything, you don't know any better. But he still had this glimmer of hope. He had this empathetic quality to him, because he was still hanging on to the fact that, his mother may still be alive, and that maybe there's that chance of reunited. And so that's actually what kind of has kept him going, is this off chance that, maybe life will be what he remembered it was before he was kidnapped.
How did you prepare yourself for the physical demands that come with any role like this? The long walks in the snow, the fighting with the various other actors in the production.
I think as an actor, your job is to keep yourself if not top physical shape, then kind of slightly above average. I think looks are important. You want to be able to transform your body. To be able to get really skinny or really fat or muscular, or that's part of that's one of your tools that you use. And so to be in good shape, I feel, is part of it for me, actually, and it's just a part of a healthy lifestyle. And as I grow older, I realize more and more the importance of it, being on top of it. And so that was just brought to the table naturally, just through the way I want to be able to grow old and have the best quality of life that I can, once, because the body will break down and betray you. I'm just trying to hold that off as long as possible.
How much would you say that your childhood in Winnipeg prepared you for the long winter shoots?
Yeah. Winnipeg will prepare you for any kind of cold weather. There's not much colder, more miserable weather on planet Earth than a Winnipeg winter, waiting at the bus stop during your high school years. And so that played a big part. I can virtually go into any sort of cold weather at this point, and my tolerance has been built up to such a degree that it might feel as bad, but there's almost nothing worse. So it played a pivotal role in me being able to handle cold weather situations.
a large chunk of the movie is just you and Gina. And when you're with an actor or a co-star in that type of situation for a long period of time, how close do you two get?
It varies depending on there's so many variables there, depending on us two as people. You know, whether we click or whether we don't, everything from what you can find you have in common to different personalities to the way you different actors work. You can kind of have a myriad of combinations that result in a certain dynamic or relationship being formed. In this particular case, me and Gina got along. I mean, we really view ourselves as like a brother-sister combination, which was a lot of fun because there was a ton of trust there. And so we would talk about the characters and what we wanted to do and what we were trying to achieve. And I feel that that's what the two characters, they inevitably came in some way to that kind of relationship where they did, there was a bond there that me and Gina had before the characters do in the film, but it became a real natural place to go. And Gina recognizes the good in everyone. She's such a positive person that I think for her character, obviously she's not playing her character, or she isn't her character, but, you know, she's got that capacity to bring a genuine feel to it of recognizing the good in someone and maybe believing in that, which I think led to our relationship up there on the mountain while we were traveling. And so we had a great time. I mean, she's as tough as they come as well. No complaints. You know, we made sure that we made it a positive experience both for each other and for the rest of the cast and crew that were working for us because we know they are tough conditions. So she was a real, you know, champion of making sure, you know, everyone was comfortable and having fun and laughing and everything else. And so it was a big, you know, it's a great memory for me to have. It was a great experience. We're still friends now. We still talk and chat and all that stuff. So it was a relationship that I'll probably, you know, have, you know, forever in terms of always being able to call her and talk to her and hang out and have fun. So that was a real special thing for me to be a part of.
You mentioned that the other factor that interested you in this film was Richard Dreyfuss. The first time you were able to shoot a scene with him, just as an actor, how did you feel?
You know, I felt comfortable. You know, it was one of those things where when I get on set, I feel everyone is an equal of sorts. Obviously, you have the role in the film, and you have to recognize what role you're playing, whether you're supporting telling someone's story within the film or not, but you're all there to do a job. And so there wasn't, and he didn't put that out there either. There was no intimidation. We had dinners and lunch before, and we had gone over the script, and we had several conversations. So arriving on set alongside him, even though it was a huge honor, and it was wonderful, and it was kind of surreal in some aspects, at the same time, you're there to do a job, and, you know, he's a co-worker like anybody else, and you go and attack the scene and talk about it and play with each other to make it the best, you know, scene you possibly can.
What was it like when you got tortured by him? Because you guys have a couple of pretty hefty scenes there.
Yeah. Those are always interesting to do. Those are a lot of fun trying to find the reality of you know, being tortured is something that we don't have a lot of, you know, thankfully, experience with. And so just bringing a gruesome reality to it, not trying to overplay it, but also learning to make sure that whatever it is I'm doing isn't just, done for selfish reasons, but that propels the story forward, propels how, you know, vengeful and awful a man he is, in terms of how he views human life and everything else, and then at the same time, trying to serve my story of, the fact that this is what I have been, this is how I've been brought up with a man like this, and I think it helps tell more of my story as well of why I am the way I am, why I could go along with it, but at the same time, why I thought there was always something better out there, because there clearly was. And so, the torture scene, you want it to move the story along. You don't want it there just, for the sake of torture and something gruesome and as this kind of thing for the audience, but you want it to reveal and tell a little bit more about the characters. So you try to find that aspect of it and then bring that out in your performance.
Why do you think Larson ends up making that final decision that he does?
I think it's, if he were to, there's a bunch of reasons for it, but I think ultimately his whole life has been full of regret, essentially, where he never felt he had the power, or he never stood up for the right thing, for what he knew was right, for what his, what his conscience and his soul and his mind and his heart and his brain was telling him was right. He lived amongst all these people who were doing wrong, and to stand up to them meant that you were not simply ostracized, but you were put in your place, and you would have been, killed or tortured or, beaten. And so it was a matter of just always following these rules blindly, and he's at a point where he might only have one more decision to make before his life ends, and it's a matter of how do I want to go out? This is a now or never time for him to maybe see a glimpse of the person that he's always wanted to be. And so he has to build up the courage to make that decision and to, on some small level, go out on his own terms.
So do you think he ultimately does find redemption in the end, maybe, for his past actions?
I think it was the most he could do at that time. Whether he's fully redeemed or not is, that's up to the audience and everyone else to decide. But, you don't get to, when you live a life that he's lived and done the things he's done, you don't get to erase all of that with any sort of amount of works or deeds or actions. It's more of something that we, in our society, with people coming out of prison, it's an, or having committed some crime, it's an ongoing thing of continually living a life, getting better and proving, working towards becoming a better person and getting farther away from the person that you were at that, that moment when you were younger and made those bad decisions. And so Whether that one action erases everything, no, probably not. But it was the only thing that was available at that time. That was the most he could do. And so, in that sense, in the context of the movie and the story we're trying to tell and everything else, I thought it was it was a big step for him.
Would you say you have a favorite moment or memory from shooting?
I don't know of a particular moment per se, but you know, everything in life is always about people and relationships. Ultimately, I think that's what we're built for, and when you're able to find one that's really special and genuine and solid, it's always a fun thing. You don't always have that opportunity. It doesn't always work out that way. I've done 60 some odd projects in my life, and you know, I only have I have a few friends that are have been close to me as a result of filming with them. And because it doesn't happen on every project or even most projects, it's special when it does. So I think ultimately the great thing that I got out of this was having was my friendship with Gina, and having that kind of a relationship come out of it, because we are like a brother and sister, and we're all, you know, and we would be there for each other, given the chance, you know, and the opportunity to do so. So that was, you know, I'm a big relationship person, so that was one that will always stick out.
Well, the film is Daughter of the Wolf. It's out in the States now, and I believe it comes out in Canada August 9th? Do I have that right?
Sounds close.
Yeah, it comes out in Canada in August. Brendan Fair, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you very much. I hope you enjoy the movie, and I hope the rest of my fellow Canucks up there will enjoy it as well when it comes up.
Yes, for sure. I'm sure we can all relate to those harsh winters.
Exactly.
All right.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, man. Take care. Have a good one.
You as well.
Bye.
Thanks, Dan.
That was my conversation with actor Brendan Fair. His newest film, Daughter of the Wolf, is out now. My next guest is a Toronto-based writer, educator, and bookbinder. She is a collaborator on the dance piece Kismet, Opposing Destiny, with choreographer Shahar Zarif, in which she wrote poems based on the dance's movements. The work is being presented as part of this year's Dance Made in Canada, Fait au Canada Festival, from August 14th through 18th. Her main focus has been fiction writing, and she is currently putting the finishing touches on a novel about aviator Amelia Earhart called Letters to Amelia. She is the founder of the Love Lettering Project and has published two picture books based on the project that are set for publication. She is Lindsay Zier Vogel, and I spoke with her earlier this week. Lindsay Zier Vogel, hello, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you so much.
So, you are taking part in dance festival, Dance Made in Canada, Fait au Canada. And what's really interesting, I find, is that you're sort of mixing dance with poetry and words. I know you study dance, but your background's in writing. Where did this piece come from for you? How did this collaboration start?
So I have been working with dance and poetry for quite a while. So that's how the artistic director of the company I used to work with her, through her series 808, I used to write poems based on every monthly show, which I cannot believe how much collaboration we did then. And then I would create a little art piece out of each one. So that was 2001, 2002, around there. So quite a while ago. So when I stopped dancing, I started writing a lot more because my voice was a lot stronger as a writer. But I really love and still do love being part of the rehearsal and creation process. So it's so much fun and such a, you know, it feels like home a little bit to be back in a studio and not have to dance. So Yvonne approached me through her Arts Encounters program to see if I could do that all over again. So I got to.
It strikes me that poetry is the most mobile of the written words. How do you find it? Poetry translates on stage into an actual tactile art form, if you will.
So I've done a few different processes with a bunch of different choreographers. So sometimes I've written text, and I've done this for Yvonne too with an other piece of hers, and we kind of deemed it a poetic dramaturg. So I would write and then send her the writing based on the creation, like the choreographic process of that day, and she would, that would sort of inform where she would go choreographically. It didn't necessarily make it onto the stage or into the performance, but it informed it. I've done other work where the text is actually performed on stage. So in Shannon Litzenberger's Homebody, the poetry that I wrote throughout the creative process was actually incorporated into the performance. And then with this, this wasn't supposed to be like a direct relationship with the choreographer, so I wasn't influencing him, he wasn't influencing me necessarily. It was just supposed to be a response to the choreographic process. So that's sort of what I got to play with this. So it was kind of nice to have, not to have the expectation that it was going to be, you know, performed or included in the performance, so that is fun. I sort of had like an extra step away from that to sort of just create.
And I know that the piece that the poems were written in response to was Kismet, Opposing Destiny, by Shahar Zarif, if I'm correct.
Yeah.
And that's sort of about shamanic transformation rituals and embodying space. And I know, do you see any similarities, you know, between your work and his work, and, you know, maybe your transformation as an artist?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I haven't thought of it like that. I feel like, I haven't thought of it like that. I think because I sort of jumped into this choreographic process a few days in, and I was there for a few days and then sort of jumped back out, I was sort of a bit more of a fly on the wall. So I don't know if I can fully speak to his choreographic process. Like, there was just so much going on that I feel like I barely scratched the surface in really embodying or understanding. I feel like there was a lot. So I was trained in a, you know, very contemporary, like Western contemporary, very sort of rigid program. That's sort of the work, that's like how I was trained. And this work was a lot more about like using voice and breath and spontaneity and sort of leaving the ego behind, whereas, you know, Western contemporary dance has a lot more ego sort of involved in its practice. So I feel like I was so fascinated by a lot of like the entry point into the work, but I don't know whether I've really considered how his process and sort of my process are maybe connected or not.
How much do you think your writing, you know, whether it's poetry or fiction or whatever, changes and transforms from when you first have the idea to when it first hits the page to when it's finally finished?
Oh, gosh. I feel like with poetry, for this, I haven't written a lot of poetry recently because I've been working on a novel that is now done, thank goodness, but and I find that I find it very difficult to switch between the two forms. When I'm sort of have my poetry lens on, I have my poetry lens on, and when I have my fiction lens on, I have my fiction lens on. I find it tricky to flip between the two. The exception being when I get to be in part of a choreographic process where I feel like the fiction sort of novel narrative can't exist because contemporary influence dance often doesn't have that narrative, you know, structure quality to it, which I love. So I do feel like it's an easier flip for me to get back into the sort of poetry world when I'm in a rehearsal or when I'm watching dance or when I'm like even watching a performance. But I find that the poems, I generally in my like writing process, in its totality, I write a lot. Like I write a lot. And then I just edit. So with poems, you know, the three poems that I wrote for this piece, you know, I wrote how many pages? 25, 30 pages, handwritten pages in during the choreographic process. And then it's three very, very short little poems that came out of it. So again, I took a lot, whittled it down. And I mean, and the novel writing process is like, you know, that times an exponential factor. So in that way, it's similar, but I feel like the number of pages is a lot fewer when I'm writing poetry.
You know, I know you got your degrees in writing, but you also study dance and you were a dancer for years. And I'm curious, when you write, are you thinking in sort of any musical rhythm or flow? And does that impact or influence your writing process at all?
I don't think I was ever actually a very musical dancer, to be honest. I also played past tense. I still have a piano. I don't play very often. I played piano. Like I've had music in my life a lot, but I don't know if that was always my internal strength. I always found it was the sort of physicality first and then music second. A lot of people are the other way around. So I don't feel like there's like necessarily a musicality in my writing, but I do feel like what I've been told anyways by people who read my work is that there's a lot, like the physicality is quite present in my work. So the way bodies are described or where the way bodies move or the observations that people have about other people's bodies is very much present.
You also mentioned that you're working on a novel,
mm-hmm.
Love Letters to Amelia, which is about Amelia Earhart.
Mm-hmm. And Letters to Amelia.
Yep. I mean, I studied Amelia Earhart in high school, but it seems like even within the last decade, even 5 years, there's been this renewed interest in her as a historical figure. And there was an article a few years ago about like whether or not they actually found her remains in the South Pacific. What was the appeal of Amelia Earhart for you, and why did you want to create a story around her?
So I think for that very reason, I feel like I would even say that, you know, I started writing about Amelia in 2003, on and off. Like I didn't start writing this novel until 2 and a bit years ago, but Amelia just constantly pops up in our cultural zeitgeist. Like she's, you know, there was that like movie that Hilary Swank was in, and then a few years before, like I feel like she just constantly, like every 5 or 10 years she pops up again, and you know, someone will find something about her or someone will have a theory about her, and then, you know, everyone rushes to figure out if it's true or not. And because the fascination of in her disappearance, I feel like, and because no one has any answers, I feel like there's just, you know, there's just so much intrigue about what happened. My book has a bit of that part of it in it. In the book, my character Grace writes letters to Amelia. That's why the book is titled Letters to Amelia. And she writes these letters as if Amelia is present and alive, even though she knows that she's not. But so she processes her own losses and her own grief and her own triumphs through these letters to Amelia in the way that you know, she's quite familiar with her in the way that, you know, people are like, oh, Meghan Markle lived in Toronto, we were like, you know, adjacent BFFs, but clearly like we don't know Meghan Markle any more than we hear about her in the news and in the media, and but we can feel this affinity and we can feel this connection and we can feel like, oh, well, we would be best friends if only we, you know, lived beside each other or whatever. I feel like there's this collective fascination with famous people and not letting them sort of be on a, I mean, yes, they're on a pedestal, but also like what makes them relatable? What makes us want to be best friends with them? I feel like there's an element of that that I find really fascinating. And I was also drawn to the parts of Amelia that aren't generally popularized. So she was a social worker and worked with Chinese and Syrian refugees in the 20s, which I just find incredible and fascinating and really relevant to, you know, now. She may or may not have had a baby out of wedlock in the 20s, which, again, super fascinating. She worked as a nurse during the First World War in Toronto, which, you know, speaks to me in that Meghan Markle sort of way where I was like, oh my God, she was here. So I feel like I had a whole bunch of entry points in that weren't just, you know, her disappearance, but I feel like her disappearance is the part that sort of keeps bringing her back into our collective focus.
There's a lot of scholarly work that paints her as an early feminist icon, feminist hero. Have you thought about that at all? And does that influence the story you were trying to tell about her at all?
I mean, I think she absolutely was. I think she was on so many levels. She had a clothing line where she designed clothes for women so they could fly airplanes, which, you know, women were supposed to be wearing skirts and women were supposed to be wearing dresses. And, you know, she cut her hair really short because it just made no sense to have long hair when you're flying airplanes with open cockpits. She really lived and embodied a feminist life and a feminist reality long before long before it was popular, for sure. And yeah, I mean, in that way, I find her so compelling and so fascinating. And, you know, when she got married, she spent a lot of time not getting married and refusing marriage. And when she finally did get married, she wrote this quite extraordinary sort of prenup to her husband saying, if we're not happy in a year, we dissolve this. If you want to go and be with other people, you do that. And I will do the same. And we will not keep each other in cages. We will live our lives as we want to live. Like, it's pretty remarkable for especially the 30s. And for a woman to sort of initiate, it was pretty amazing.
In the course of your writing this book and your research, do you have any theories about what happened to Amelia?
You know, it's funny. I don't. And I find that part of the story a lot less fascinating than the rest of her story. I mean, chances are her plane disappeared into the ocean. That's sort of my personal take on it. But then there are just so many conspiracy theories about what might have happened. And I think it's more, you know, it's more in the what if, and it's more in the story, and it's more in who she was in her life than it is sort of about her end. For me,
if that wasn't enough, you're finished that novel. I know you're also working on a what's called here a place-making nonfiction book.
Yeah.
Happy Fear, the DIY Guide to Loving Where You Live.
Yeah, so that is sort of sitting on my computer at the moment. I haven't worked on it in a little bit. So I have a project called the Love Lettering Project, where I get people to write love letters to their communities. I've been doing it since 2004, and people have been doing it in Brazil and up in the... I did a 5-city tour of the UK, and I went up to the Canada's North and did a whole bunch of work. I just finished an event at the Word on the Street Festival in Toronto here. It's so much fun getting people to sort of reframe the you know, it's really easy to complain about what doesn't work in your community, and it's, I think, a really vital practice to think about what does work in your community. Then I get people to hide these letters for strangers to find to spread the love. So I've been doing that for a whole bunch of years now, and this guide I probably need to get back working on it, sort of brings that idea of how to engage and how to love where you live, for people to sort of engage with their communities. But I took a little pause from that nonfiction project and instead wrote a kid's book under the same premise. So the little girl writes love letters to her community. They sort of start spreading and people start sort of refinding the goodness in their community. And that is actually going to be published by Kids Can Press in 2021 with a follow-up book in 2022. So I feel like I took a little bit of a pause from the adult version and wrote the kids version instead.
And why did you want to start the love lettering project? What was it about? Did you have a love affair with the city of Toronto, do you think? Or where did that come from for you?
So the first year I did it, it wasn't a project at all. It was just a friend and I with a bunch of airmail envelopes and some poems we had written that we slipped them in and just sort of hid them in the city as on our walk home. And then the next, so that was sort of in the summer in 2004. And then the next year I was in grad school and was spending a lot of time at Robarts Library, which some people love. I find it a very difficult place to spend a lot of time in February. I was feeling quite dreary. So I got people to send me books that they loved or books they thought needed love. And I wrote love poems to these love letters to these books and then hid them in the stacks. And so it wasn't because I was in love with anything, it was because I really needed to feel some goodness. And the feeling I got after I, you know, had hidden all these letters, like all of a sudden that whole building was totally transformed. Like there was so much potential for goodness there. There was so much potential for love. And so, yeah, the next year I, you know, in the middle of February or, you know, some dismal dark time in the year, I decided, like, that was really fun. I should do that again. So the project was sort of born out of the dreary February-ness and how to bring light into that space. And then I started working with kids and I started getting other people to hide the letters. I decided one year to hide 500 letters. And so that was, it took a lot longer than I anticipated to hide 500 across the city. And so, you know, when I was, you know, I'd be hiding them, you know, when I was with friends or with family and people started saying like, oh, can I help you hide them? And I realized that maybe it wasn't just the receiving the letter part of the project that was engaging, but also the hiding the part of the letter. So the next year I sort of experimented with what if I, you know, set up tables and sort of outsource the entire project to people walking by. And that's sort of where it really, really took off.
And another thing I find fascinating is you do your own book binding.
I do.
Using all sorts of techniques. How does one get into that art form?
You know, it was a very, I love paper. I've always loved paper. And I write poetry. So, and I did a lot sort of back in my sort of early 20s, which is when I got really into bookbinding. So I took a course with Don Taylor, who's this extraordinary bookbinder. He's so amazing, through the Japanese Paper Place. And I mean, poor Don, every time he looks at any of my books, he's like, this is so wonky. How did you do this? Because I don't quite follow he was very meticulous and I am very not meticulous, but I figured out a way to make books without being meticulous. With a lot of eyeballing, which, you know, sorry, Don. So I started doing a lot of that. I was really involved with the small press community and running the small press book fair in Toronto, again, a lot of years ago in the early 2000s. And it was just a way to sort of get my work out in the world in a way that, you know, I didn't have enough poems or enough high quality poems for a poetry manuscript, but I could put it out myself. And I loved sort of designing the books and using embroidery and using different kind of papers. So that's sort of how I got into it. And I haven't done it in a while. The last time I was sort of making books, a whole bunch of them are now at the Thomas Fisher Rare Books Library, which actually also features in my Letters to Amelia book, The Library. And so they have a whole bunch of my books in their permanent collection. And then I just sort of, I guess I had a bunch of kids and I was working on these novels, so I didn't really have a lot of poems to put into a book. So it's been really lovely to get back into binding again through this Arts Encounters project. It's been a lot of fun.
How would you compare the art of creating a book binding versus the art of writing poetry or novel versus the art of dance, let's say?
Well, I find writing and bookbinding is really solitary, which really suits me. Creating dances usually requires a lot of people, which I find really difficult to, or found, I don't do it anymore, I found it really difficult to sort of, you know, find that creativity in a studio and you know, find the money to find that studio and then find the money to find dancers and the musician. Like I found that part quite overwhelming. I much prefer to be by myself, which I still do. So I really value the solitary nature of sort of the bookbinding and writing personally. I also, you know, there's something about the ephemeralness of dance that is quite extraordinary and you know, the need for an audience, like a physical room, an audience that is quite magical. I don't know if that's how my work is best experienced. So I feel like, you know, having that one-on-one direct connection with a reader works better for me and for my voice creatively. So I feel like that just works for sort of how I am as an artist.
Do you think you'll ever write a book about dance or have a character that is a dancer?
Funny you should ask. I'm working on a new novel, and the main character is a musician, but she has a friend, one of her best friends is a dancer. So I just wrote this really long scene about her going to a dance show, and it was so much fun to write. It was so much fun to write about contemporary dance in a theater, because it's you know, critics write about dance, and of course scholars write about dance, but there's not a lot of fiction about dance. I mean, Zadie Smith wrote a beautiful novel with a dancer as a main character, and there's always like little bits here and there in pieces I find, but you can always tell when someone is not writing, is writing about dance, isn't a dancer, or doesn't have a dance background, or doesn't talk to enough dancers, because there's often like a plie, a tondo, and arabesque, and that's sort of it. So yeah, it's really fun to write about dance. I mean, I'm not writing about the main character isn't a dancer, but maybe one day. It's been really fun to write about.
Wait, when you write, how much do you pull from your own life?
I feel like most writers, you know, no more, no less. I feel like, you know, the capacity of the human imagination is quite extraordinary to create characters and put them in different situations. So, I mean, you know, every now and then, like an apartment layout will be sort of, you know, that apartment that I used to live on Palmerston, that'll be the sort of layout in my head. So I don't sort of have to invent that, but you know, the rest is really, I think, you know, it's fiction, it's imaginary, it comes from my imagination.
There's one more writing project I wanted to ask you about, and that is Swimming Holes We Have Known. What is it about swimming and being by the water? What drew you to that life?
So I've always been a swimmer. My grandparents had a cottage when I was a kid, so we spent, you know, 8 weeks of the summer in the lake until we were, you know, told that we had to eat meals, my sister and I. And I was a lifeguard, and I've always been sort of involved with swimming in pools. And after I was really injured when I stopped dancing, and the one thing that I could do was swim. So that was really healing for me. It was one place that I felt like I could be a physical being again, because when I was sort of on land, there was just a lot of pain. So it's always been quite healing. And then I find that it's where I do all of my best thinking. It's when I, you know, come up with all of the, it's when I do all my problem solving. It's where I came up with the idea for this Arts Encounters project. It's where I, you know, came up with the idea for the new novel I'm working on. It's where, like, it's really when I'm swimming, there's something about that sort of sensory deprivation, not being able to hear things, not being able to be on my phone, not being able to be, you know, have anything asked of me, or those 45 minutes or an hour. There's something about that that's just really liberating and really sort of creatively fruitful. So yeah, friends of mine are also big swimmers, so we just sort of made this blog, and one is doing a lot more design work now, and the other one is doing a whole bunch of other sort of illustration quilting work. So I sort of am the sort of primary voice on the blog now, but it's so much fun to connect with people through swimming. I've met some really wonderful people sort of in the UK and elsewhere through swimming. It's really fun. It's sort of a different way of writing for me. I don't often write nonfiction stuff, especially not personal stuff, so it's fun to just, you know, have an outlet for that.
Where is the best swimming spot in Toronto?
Sunnyside Pool.
Sunnyside Pool.
Yeah, it's my favorite place in Toronto. But if you want to swim in the lake, I would say off the island. Hanlon's Point is beautiful.
Oh, you know, I've been to the island, but I've never got to swim off Hanlon's Point, but I hear it's absolutely gorgeous.
It's magic. I would highly recommend it.
Well, your show is 3 days in June. which is based...
That's the book, yeah.
Which is based off Kismet Opposing Destiny in the Dance Made in Canada, Fait au Canada Festival, August 14th to 18th at the Betty Oliphant Theatre. Lindsay Zierwogel, thanks so much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you so much.
Alrighty, have a good day.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
That was my conversation with writer, educator, and bookbinder Lindsay Zierwogel. The Dance Made in Canada, Fait au Canada Festival, runs August 14th through 18th. That about does it for the show this week. My thanks to Brendan Fair and Lindsay Zierwogel. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now.
I just like to have a lot of sex.